Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Aramar Tefio on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience.
Hello, I'm Stuart Alexander, and once again, I would like to welcome you to the Socialist Insight. Today, we have John Strinka. He's joining the program once again. He's been on the program several times in the past, especially when he was running as a candidate for the 39th District in Indiana. And today, he's joining the program where we're going to be discussing a very interesting subject that affects all working people. And also, it affects Wall Street in a positive way. A positive way for Wall Street and a negative way for working people. And today, John is going to be discussing with us Wall Street gains and working people and how those gains on Wall Street affect working people. John, thanks again for joining the program.
Hey, glad to be here, Stuart. Thanks for having me. It's a great topic you've got, and I'm really eager to talk with you about it. I think the timing is very appropriate, and it's something we need to go into.
John, you know, we hear a lot about what is taking place on Wall Street and the phenomenal success that Wall Street has had since the 2008 crash. And we have talked about this several times. We can see that the 2008 crash that took place here in the U.S. and spread throughout the world, that it hasn't ended yet. We hear all the time discussions on television, on the Internet, about how the economy is coming back. But in reality, working people really don't see the economy coming back. And we can see this in many ways. John, what you can see in regards to what the information that is being put out through the media, that is being put out through television, do you see any signs that there's any type of recovery for working people considering all the successes for Wall Street?
Well, of course, as it turns out, I mean, the unemployment numbers are, you know, still in the dumps. People are still out of work. People have still lost their homes, and they're not getting new homes anytime soon. And the fact is that there is a gigantic disconnect. And, I'm really glad you're having this program because the current situation just makes it abundantly clear how badly off track the capitalist system has gotten. And what the specifics are, and I guess, you know, we can draw this out over time. But I mean, you know, to a certain extent, you know, you've had in the past an acceptance of Keynesian, you know, liberal economics and so forth. And to a certain extent, very specifically in the quarter century from 1948-1973, you could make the argument that those policies worked. Well, the thing is this. It's now been 40 years since the implicit bargain that made that liberal compromise work had been violated, okay? And what is happening is the inevitable logic of capitalism. And what happens is when you organize activity for profit, when you do it entirely for profit without regard to the communities that the activity should serve, this is invariably going to happen. And that's exactly what we're seeing. So what I want to talk about specifically, and I think most people in the United States, okay, we are a very, I think, the confident, you know, self-reliant kind of people. And that's a good thing, okay?
Uh-huh.
But, you know, we've been educated and sold on this propaganda. Well, you know, the businesses, you know, work for everyone. And the fair profit is simply, you know, their return for putting it all together. And what has happened is, to begin with, that was never true in the first place. I mean, it was only incidentally true. I mean, the point is, if business has to build in, you know, over a century ago, has to build a national network of railways, well, be sure they're doing it for their own profitability, but the fact that you have this infrastructure now built allows it to be used for, you know, for public purposes, okay? So the truth of that argument came from the incidental benefits, okay? But here's what's going on now, okay? I mean, in post-industrial America, okay, capitalists no longer make most of their profit by making stuff, okay? Most profit in the contemporary world, in the globalized economy, is made very simply from speculation, okay?
Right.
I mean, it's made on things like derivatives, on hedges, on things that produce no real wealth but are just pure raw speculation.
Now, speculation.
Exactly. And I mean speculation, again, on anything. Really, in you know, modern global economy, I mean, essentially all hedge funds are bets on the directions of various market and commodity fluctuations, okay? So, case in point, one of the biggest things that gets bet on, of course, is corporate profits, corporate earnings, okay? Now, here's where the disconnect starts to come in, okay? Because, okay, most people, again, you know, we've been conditioned, you know, work is good and you know, it's all going to work out and everybody's going to benefit. Well, there's a disconnect. That doesn't happen anymore. Because the way the capitalists make their money now, they don't even have to bother, you know, building the infrastructure, okay?
Right.
I mean, you don't have to make stuff for the people anymore. You can make the money on speculation. Now,
yeah, you don't have to. You don't even need to produce anything. You can even speculate what will take place sometime in the future.
That's precisely right. I mean, that is entirely right. And one of the perversities of this is that one of the things that gets speculated on is corporate earnings, okay? Now, the situation with that is that, of course, the problem, you know, one of the problems with capitalism, of course, is labor is regarded as an expense and only that. So,
right.
If you want to increase your earnings, what you do is you, of course, decrease your labor cost. And the way you do that, particularly in American context, is basically you bankrupt corporations, you reorganize them, you get rid of the jobs, what jobs are necessary to be done, you ship overseas, and you have them done for essentially slave wages. Now, what happens is all of these things make the corporate bottom line thicker, better, okay? It increases profits. There's no doubt about it.
Right, exactly. Right?
But the point is, the communities, and particularly, again, the Americans, are left without jobs. And I mean, we've gotten to the point right now where the middle class that existed half a century ago is effectively defunct. I mean, we've been wiped out. I mean, I think personally, you and I are kind of like sort of members of that defunct middle class, you know?
Right.
You basically spend all your time, you know, working just to meet your obligations.
Yeah, not working one job now. I'm working, like, sometimes two and three jobs.
I personally did not know that, because you worked a lot of hours at your one job.
No, I'm saying many working people are working sometimes one and two jobs and sometimes three jobs.
Oh, that's been that's been the norm for quite some time,
particularly
for manual labor and so forth. I mean, the thing is, you don't have factory jobs that pay $20 an hour. What you have are, you know, jobs at the Amazon warehouse that will pay maybe a dollar above minimum wage. And, you work 40 hours for that, and then you go right on to your next job, because if you want to have both a car and a place to stay, well, $8 an hour is not going to cut it for you. So there you go. You have your second job. And it's obviously, I mean, we're going clear back to, to the pre-industrial kind of oppression.
And what is happening, John, is I was just reading a recent article where we're saying U.S. economy recovery doesn't fool struggling Americans. And it doesn't fool them, because people can see what is taking place in their communities, what they see taking place in their state, and even nationally. They can see the people that they encounter every day, that people are struggling. And even when they come out with the unemployment data, where they can say it's 7.7%, it's still higher than what it was when Obama took office. And we still have close to 25 million people that are unemployed. But one of the things I found very interesting was it was saying, what's more than half of those surveyed believe the U.S. economy will not fully recover for another 6 years, and nearly one-third said the U.S. economy will never fully recover. And today we can see that there's no real recovery taking place. And then one of the other things that said in the article says, last August in a Pew Research survey of middle-class Americans, 42% said they were worse off than what they were in 2008. Now that I can relate to. But the numbers, when you look at the numbers, reality is setting in, where people can see that they're still working very hard. They're trying to prepare either for their retirements. They're trying to be able to manage their expenses at home. But things aren't getting any better. And when they keep saying that Wall Street is doing well and the economy is, we have a stronger economy and the recession is behind us, and all this about we need to avoid a double dip recession and all that, but Wall Street is doing better, but working people are not. Reality is taking hold of most working people. Case in point, when you go into the grocery store, when you look at when you go up to a gas pump, you see the cost of gasoline is almost twice as much as what it was even 5 or 6 years ago. We don't see it as working people when they talk about the successes for Wall Street. Day to day, we can't see this on Main Street.
Oh, you're absolutely right. I mean, that is absolutely correct. And, again, I want to come back to the point that there is a real disconnect. I mean, the way the capitalists, the owners of the capitalist system make money has been totally divorced from the interest of the people. I mean, it used to be, to have an enterprise going, you would need to have workers, and generally, if the people running the organization had any sense, it paid off to treat those workers fairly, But the point is, that whole notion of the social contract has gone away. It hasn't existed in the United States for 40 years, and it's only just now that people are beginning to see it. I mean, the truth of it is, and you can look at the data, you can look at the statistics, okay? One of the ways corporations pad their bottom line is by eliminating labor cost. All right. I mean, file bankruptcy, and what's the first thing that the bankruptcy court allows to be thrown out? Well, the corporation can throw out their pension obligations. They can throw out their union contract, right?
So right.
In the cost of saving money. Well, I mean, what happened to the idea of, you know, a bargain or agreement in good faith being honored. I mean, what corporate America has been doing for the past 40 years is basically walking into courts of law, our courts of law, and having their, you know, agreed to obligations to their workers simply eliminated. And
right, exactly.
and the way that a corporation, if you take a look at you know, the stock prices and so forth, one of the surest ways you can get a bump to the stock price is to announce a massive layoff. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, guys like Chainsaw L. Dunlop, I mean, a whole, you know, a gallery of corporate stars basically have made their reputations by doing this. I mean, one of the things that totally enrages me is the fact that in the last election, I mean, one of the actual candidates for president actually earned his living by doing exactly this, buying up corporations, splitting them apart, selling off the parts, and eliminating the jobs. And this,
exactly.
And this guy, and obviously, you know, I'm talking about Romney, but this
right.
guy had the audacity to try to tell the American people that this was a good thing to be doing. I mean,
right.
it shows you how
he said this is the way business
the communication is. The New York
he said this is the way business operates.
Well, it, yes, and I mean, and this is why we're socialists, because the point is that the logic of it when you take a system and you say that profit is the sole measure of good, it is the sole measure of value. Well, then the logical extension of that is that you can do anything to generate a profit. And, you know, one of the easiest ways to generate a profit is to basically plunder it from those who are powerless to defend themselves. And sadly, that's exactly what we have going on. I mean, in effect, I mean, we are in the beginning of a new emerging kind of feudalism, where not the feudal lord oppresses the peasants, but our employers and the owners of the corporations that employ them are instead being our oppressors. You know, it always amuses me. I'm going to diverge a bit here, but you know,
uh-huh.
obviously there's a lot of anger, you know, about the government not protecting us, and that gets mistranslated into anger against the government. Now, it's very true that even under the current, you know, Democratic administration, our government is totally owned. And I mean, totally owned by corporate Wall Street interest. It's being, and we've talked many times before, if you take a look at the bailout, you know, that $700 billion could have been used to refinance people's mortgages. It
right.
could have been used to create employment, okay, you know, via the way they did in the New Deal. It could have gone directly to the benefit of the people affected by this. Instead, it went to the banks. The people were cut out, lost their jobs, lost their homes. I mean, you know, something is very, very wrong with this system. And at this point, particularly, there have been, you know, a multitude of books written on the collapse of 2008. And I
right.
mean, and they've been written by everyone from, you know, Michael Levin to, you know, to, you know, just all authority, Stiglitz, you know, Nobel Prize winner in economics, basically, you know, pointing out that the failures of 2008 was nothing short of a colossal fraud. That the people who engineered this whole thing knew exactly what they were doing. And
oh,
yet,
yeah. 2008, in my opinion, was a new world order. And most people don't realize that it was a complete change in economics for the whole world. Because what happened in 2008 is still going on today, and we see a total transformation of world economies. And we're going to talk about Cyprus in a few minutes.
Yes.
And it's still going on.
Yeah, and actually, this is a great place to bring up Cyprus. And, you know, we had talked about it. And this is just, and I apologize for not perhaps being as versed on this as I should be because it's late-breaking news. But quite incredibly, as it turns out, and honestly, I had not known this, but Cyprus is an offshore haven in much the same way that Cayman's Island and Liechtenstein and, you know, places like that are, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And what's happened is they are now at the point of a crisis. And my understanding is that the EU has come up with a plan wherein the Cypriot government will actually begin confiscation, you know, taxation of regular deposits of
bank
regular
deposits.
People who had nothing to do with the crisis to pay for it. And
right.
If you stop and think about it, that's a very, very radical measure. And again, it's no different than robbing, you know, the common people with a gun. I mean, you know, okay, look, the speculators have gotten themselves into a jam, and you are going to pay for their mistakes. I mean,
right.
It is blatantly, obviously wrong, and it's so blatantly obvious it can't be hidden anymore.
Right. And one of the things, and as you mentioned, even governments, including Russia, they're looking at, you know, that this is something that's very a blatant violation of, you know, the rights of working people. And this is something that not only Cyprus, but we're starting to see this same type of activities cropping up all over the world. We saw some of the austerity measures that took place in the 90s when they came in, when you were looking at the debt crisis in Mexico and when NAFTA was introduced. And that's what banks are doing, is they look at the debt that is created in various countries, and then they come in with these various austerity measures. And in the case of what we were just referring to, where people are being taxed basically for no reason at all other than certain restrictions that are being imposed because of the economy of that nation. One of the things I see when I look at this country, and just very briefly on when I was referring to NAFTA, We saw the impact that took place in the 90s under the Clinton administration. And, of course, the nation had a lot of debt that they owed to the banks at that time. And then they were to have some of that debt relieved. They were basically coerced into signing that agreement, which has brought the economy essentially to a halt, and the economy hasn't recovered from that even since then, and that's been close to 15 years, and we see over 15 years, and the same thing that is happening in other places around the world. I just wanted to mention another thing, and this is according to economist John Williams, and what he says, the recovery is illusory. An illusion. He says, it's fake. Phony government numbers conceal weakness. Growth has not occurred since 2006 and 2007. There's no growth anymore. There's no jobs, real jobs that are being created. There's no manufacturing. Everything that we're seeing, when we look at Wall Street, John, the numbers are fake. The jobs that the government is reporting, they're fake. Everything is fake. They're basically lies that we're receiving from many sources, whether it's the newspaper or television, the internet, but it's lies built on lies. John, where does it end?
Well, I mean, I think where it ends, I understand it's a rhetorical question, but I mean, quite honestly,
I think that was a rhetorical question. I was really asking myself.
What's that? I'm sorry.
I see. I think that was a rhetorical question. No, I'm really asking myself, where does it end?
The point is, rhetorical or not,
right.
You know, it really begs an answer, because I don't think that people have properly understood it. And where it's going to end is in the collapse of contemporary capitalism. And the frightening thing about that is that, well, don't want to get...
And that's a good point that you bring up.
Misunderstood, but the point is, we are now 7 billion strong of us, you know, on the people, okay? We are at the point, you know, inconceivable as little as half a century ago, where we are pressing up against the actual physical limits of the planet. I mean, you know, in the United States, you know, we're blessed, okay? Particularly, you know, those of us in the east and the middle of the country have abundant water. For those, you know, such as you in the west, well, you don't have abundant water, but you can divert the Colorado River and still manage to have enough for everybody, and nobody really kind of notices it. But you know, I mean, even within this country, there's starting to be resource constraints. And the point is this. Capitalism is an enormously wasteful system. I mean, we just pointed out, you know, we have this boom and bust, profits, you know, get generated and dissolved in a crash. And, you know, when there were a billion of us on the planet, which was less than two centuries ago, which is kind of staggering if you stop and think about it, I mean, you know, it still looked like we had infinite wealth. Well, now that there are 7 billion of us, you know, we're beginning to run up against real constraints in natural resources. I mean, not to be an alarmist, I want to be very careful, you know. It's not that, you know, things are running out and that we're going to have a collapse. But the point is, we're going to have to manage things consciously for use, and use those things productively and not wastefully if our civilization is going to survive. And I mean,
well, what is happening, John, what I can see is you mentioned about the resources, but you mentioned about management. We're not properly managing those resources. We're not properly managing labor. Basically, labor has been put out to pasture. We don't need people to work because that's profit. We're not using the resources. We're not putting people to work to develop those resources because we're trying to see how we can just create money out of nothing. And subsequently, those resources are not being developed for our future use. So we do see those resources diminishing.
Well, that's exactly right. And I mean, there's no question about it. I mean, you know, there, you know, a plethora of studies, but, you know, anything you choose to read by, you know, engineering surveys, things of that nature, basically all indicate that American infrastructure is deteriorating. I mean, you know, again, we...
And that's a good point you bring up. We're going to talk about Detroit in just a few minutes.
Yeah, and that is a painful thing.
When you talk about how the infrastructure is deteriorating, but it's not just Detroit, but it's really the whole country. But anyway, finish your thought.
Well, no, I mean, yeah, and Detroit itself is something to get into. But,
John, I'm just going to move this on.
Yeah, go ahead.
I just want to just make an introduction. Once again, we have John Strinka. He's joining us again today on the Socialist Insight. And, John, he's been with us several times in the past when he was running as a candidate for the 39th District in Indiana. John is very knowledgeable on things dealing with the economy and also on state issues. And that's one of the reasons why we have him joining us today, discussing Wall Street gains and working people. And once again, John, I'd like to welcome, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Oh, thank you, Stuart. Great to be here. I appreciate the invitation. And, of course, as we pointed out, I think your topic is incredibly appropriate because, you know, this, I think, really exposes in a very straightforward way, the bankruptcy of the system. I mean,
the bankruptcy of the system, and what else, John?
Well, I was just saying, it is so tiresome to hear the Wall Street reports, and of course, in the last couple of weeks, the newspapers have been all agog with, the Dow exceeds 14,000, and it's a record high, and we've now restored, all the losses from 2007, 2008. And, of course, what you've pointed out, and what's true to, any working person, is that, well, yes, the corporate bottom lines have recovered, and they're all showing nice profits, but they're doing it without bringing back the jobs. The people who lost their houses in the crash are, still don't have homes. And I mean that, yes, by various financial manipulations, yes, these companies are profitable, but the profitability has not been shared with the everyday, ordinary working people of America.
John, let's talk about a few of those things. It just shows the disconnect.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about some of those things where you mentioned about the profit has not been shared with the everyday working people. Military spending. Military spending right now, we're looking at close to $700 billion, even though we saw President Obama when he was running for re-election. He was saying he wanted to see military spending cut in half. We still see it on the increase. People don't realize that with the military spending and defense spending, almost half the budget, almost half of our national budget is used just for defense and military spending. Healthcare costs. This is something that benefits Wall Street directly. Doesn't necessarily benefit working people. Many jobs are cutting back on the health care that they provide to their employees, and they're passing that cost on. But Wall Street still benefits because now they have Obamacare saying that you're going to have health care. No matter what the cost, you're going to have to pay for it. They got rid of the option and made certain that people were left holding the bag. Inflation, we see inflation. It's up everywhere you go, in the grocery stores, as I mentioned, the gas pump, wherever you go. The feds are dumping hundreds of billions of dollars still into this economy. They're dumping almost $50 billion a month into the economy. Where is it going? Is it improving the infrastructure? Is it creating jobs? This is what is happening. They say Wall Street is doing well. Also, as I mentioned, the gasoline prices. We see gasoline prices. One of the unfortunate things I see, John, is they are now accepting the high prices. People are starting to say that, well, $4.25 a gallon is not too much. The next step would be $5 or $6 a gallon. John, this is where I see the gains of Wall Street, is that they're benefiting from things that are not necessarily, as you mentioned earlier, speculation, military spending, a lot of things that the government is controlling, and all of that is going to benefit Wall Street. And as I mentioned, the feds, where they're dumping almost $50 billion a month into this economy that is not creating jobs. John, how do you answer the madness of this Congress, this government, Washington, D.C., and this president? How do you answer that?
Well, clearly you can't. And I mean, the explanation is that the 1%, let's kind of go back to the language of Occupy because it's very accurate, but it's the 1% that benefits from this. It's the 1% that's bought and paid for the government. I mean, anyone who cares to look, I mean, there's always, a certain trotting out of the, the cultural brand. Republicans, of course, are for, fundamentalism and all kinds of other kinds of strange notions. And, of course, mm-hmm. Democrats claim to be for the people. But the point is, the Democrats most emphatically are not. I mean, when it comes down to, you know, some of the most harmful things for the economy, they've taken place under, you know, Democratic administrations. NAFTA was pushed through under a Democratic presidency. In fact, that was one of his major priorities. Glass-Steagall was dismantled under a Democratic presidency. And, of course, going back to the current administration, you know, there was a bailout, all right, but the bailout went entirely to the banks. The people who were bailed out were the very people responsible for the collapse and the malfeasance. I mean, in a normal structure, in a normal society, you know, the right loves to talk about accountability and about how we should all, you know, be careful about what we do because actions have consequences. And yet the people who are responsible for collapsing the economy have gotten only richer. And it's infuriating. And people see that as a miscarriage of justice. It's just, you know, we've gone about this, you know, a number of different ways, as you know, you kind of will in conversation. But, I mean, what's going on is a massive transfer of wealth. But, you know, unlike, you know, redistribution that the right wing likes to accuse us of, is what's happening. The market mechanisms are essentially rigged, and the profitability is going to that top 1%, going to Wall Street. Okay, and again, you know, we've looked at this from a matter of angles. You know, we've looked at it in terms of speculation. We've looked at it from the fact that, you know, Wall Street corporate bottom lines actually improve when you lay off people. Okay, I mean, another way of looking at it is in terms of massive externalization. Okay, I mean, it's been said that, you know, in America, what we have is that, you know, the profits are privatized; they all go to the 1%. But the risk, the pain, is actually socialized among the people, because in order to generate those profits for Wall Street, what's happening is people are losing their jobs. I mean, pure and simple. If you can make jobs go away, your corporation can make more money. But the thing is this, the people who are now unemployed, who are now, you know, now have to turn to the state for benefits just to survive. Okay, I mean, that doesn't go anywhere on the balance sheet at all. That we're all paying for. And the irony, you know, is you look at this Congress, and particularly, you know, look at the Paul Ryan's of the world, and so say, oh, well, we can't afford, you know, to pay your pension anymore. We can't afford to pay Social Security. Okay, we can't afford to pay medical care. Well, the reason you can't afford it is because all the profit is going to the 1%. I mean, it's radically, you know, become apparent that they are, you know, that society is no longer working together. I mean, our society has gotten to the point where it is as exploitative as anything in feudal Europe. I mean, you know, the difference is instead of, you know, armed thugs on horses in armor, you know, taking your wherewithal, we do it a little more indirectly, but the corporate buccaneers take it just as surely. And of course the state power is essentially used to implement those things. But it's just very difficult to make people see it. But the thing is, you know, we are not any longer in a time of shared sacrifices or of, you know, of working together. We have come very clearly, and the economics and the current issue, you know, Wall Street is having a recovery. Boy, things are great. Well, no, things are not great, okay, because they're making that money on the backs of the people. And what don't go into those numbers, what you don't see in those numbers, are the millions unemployed, you know, the millions underemployed, the people, you know, who are suffering, and in fact, the middle class, which is disintegrating in front of our very eyes. I mean, it the social contract in the United States, okay, I mean, it was, you know, it was never, you know, a perfect just land or anything like that, but we always have had, you know, the principles of freedom and equality. And those are being eroded because the 1% is being taken away from working people. You know, you have to run harder just to stay in the same place, and you can't even run harder anymore. I mean, you can't even get the job to provide the wherewithal. You know, and going back, I want to address something you said earlier. And I want to be careful too, because I try to be very, very careful so that, you know, people, you know, can't accuse us of overstating things, okay? And the thing is this, the way, you know, as you said, you know, a lot of the statistics and so forth are outright lies. Well, they are, but it's subtle. I'll give you a case in point. Like you talked about inflation and so forth. Now, one of the very interesting things, okay, is that the CPI, the Consumer Price Index, okay, which is basically used to adjust everything, okay? I mean, that is the accepted economic indicator, okay? Well, the CPI does not include increases in food cost or fuel cost. Now, the reasoning goes because those things are volatile and therefore not a true reflection of underlying inflation, okay? But the point is, when you take a look at the real-world implications of that, okay, there is not a working person, you know, in the country that doesn't have to pay more for gas to put gas in his car to go to work, okay? I mean, that is being effectively extracted from him. And the proceeds from that are going into oil company profits. Now, I don't want to belabor that too much because there are actual...
But that's a good point because I'm in the automobile industry, and someone, when they're looking at the MSRP on a car, the manufacturer suggests a retail price, and they look at that little section where it says your annual fuel consumption for this vehicle should be around $3,400. That's $3,400. You need to take that in consideration when you go back a decade ago, and that cost was half that. And to consider you go back a decade ago, and you're probably earning more than what you're earning today. So that becomes very relative.
Right. And I mean, and basically, you know, costs have to be shared. But I mean, there's a lot of things like that that are, you know, that okay, that happened for logical reasons, okay? But the point is, because of the system, instead of, you know, sharing the increased, you know, cost of resources, basically it all gets put upon, you know, the people, you know, the working people who need it for their wherewithal, and the profits thereby generated go to the 1%. I mean, what we're looking at, very simply, is a transfer of wealth from the many working people, you know, to the very, very few owners. And it's got to stop. I mean, income equality, wealth distribution in this country is worse now than it was during the 20s, which, of course, led up to the Great Depression. But, I mean, at this point, and you know, the numbers vary, particularly, you know, when you look at them. I like to use the EPI, Economic Policy Institute numbers, because they're very reliable. But, I mean, essentially, the top 1% of the country owns 34% of all the wealth in the country. The top 1% owns more of everything than the bottom 90%, okay? And people just don't realize this, you know? You point this out to people, you know, you talk to them, and they look at it and they said, well, you know, those people just, you know, they just did well, okay? Well, no, they didn't just do well. What they did is they bought a political system and they rigged the rules in their favor. I mean, there are blatant examples. For instance, I forgot the precise term, but the point is, derivative fund managers, okay, hedge fund managers, okay,
uh-huh.
Their earnings are categorized in a separate category, and it's on the tip of my tongue. I'm embarrassed I don't remember it. But at any rate, it's categorized in such a way that their marginal tax rate is 15%, okay?
Uh-huh.
Well, the top marginal tax rate for earned income is, you know, it's 33%, okay? And I mean, and it's totally absurd that people who make, massive, obscene amounts of money are taxed at lower rates than everyday working people. I mean, it's just not
right. Exactly.
And yet that's the law of the land. And still, you know, we've been conditioned. This faith is so strong that, well, somehow, you know, the rich deserve their wealth. Well, no, they don't. And it's gotten to the point where now that they own the state, I mean, there's nothing to stop them. I mean, it used to be.
Yeah, right, own the state.
Well, I mean, yes, of course.
No, you're right.
But, I mean, they do own the state. I mean, they pay for elections. If you take a look at particularly, and you saw just the beginning of it in the 2012 elections, but with Citizens United, I mean, the Supreme Court basically put a price tag on the Congress. I mean,
right.
it's nothing
right.
short of that. And I mean, and you know yourself, I mean, as a socialist candidate for president, you know how difficult it was to get attention.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you know, I know, you know, how hard you worked, and yet because you didn't have millions and millions of dollars, it was very hard to get, you know, media to cover you. And I mean,
when you consider the presidential candidates, two candidates alone, their campaigns cost more than $2 billion, and again, we can thank Citizens United for that.
Yeah, and it's ridiculous. And you know, not only your candidacy, but I mean, for instance, and you know, Jill Stein, who I think was an honorable candidate from the Green Party.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she was essentially detained by police for showing up at a presidential debate. I mean.
As you mentioned, as you mentioned, that we have corporate America. They really own this Congress. Well, John, we have a few more minutes here, and I just wanted to cover a few more areas. We talk about the Wall Street gains and working people, and even how Wall Street make huge profits off of students. They're going to school. They're trying to achieve an education so they can go into the workforce. And many of them, once they graduate from various colleges and universities, they can't even find a job. And I was just speaking with someone, this was a couple of weeks ago, and he was just mentioning about his college debt that he had, which was $130,000. And here, you know, he was just working. I believe he was making less than $10. He had a job making less than $10 an hour. But this debt is creating profit for the banks and the financial institutions, debt that cannot be discharged. But again, this goes to add to the profits of Wall Street. These numbers that they say Wall Street is doing great, but they're doing it on the backs again of working people.
That's exactly right. And I'll tell you, actually, you've touched on a subject here, and obviously it's precisely relevant to the point in hand. But I mean, it's such a tremendous abuse that really kind of deserves its own separate program. But I mean, of course, you know, you and I, in terms of talking to people and campaigning and so forth, have talked to many, many students. And this story is widespread. It's not isolated. I mean, 130,000 is on the high side, but it's not at all unusual.
Oh, I've seen some that are higher than that, but that
there are.
That was his bill.
But
you're right. It's on the high side.
The point how ubiquitous
right.
this is, how widespread
right.
it is, that this is not just an isolated thing. I mean,
right.
it used to be back in the day, you know, when you and I were college students, all right? I mean, if you went to a state university, okay, I mean, it wasn't easy or anything, okay? You had to do the work and the rest of it. But you were charged a tuition that if you worked hard, you could actually pay. Well, you were a student, okay?
Right.
I mean, and that was because state government subsidized your university systems. Obviously, there were benefits for, like, veterans, GI Bill, you know, where people from less advantaged backgrounds could have education. But even the states, for everyday people, you know, if you could make it into the state university, they would charge you a reasonable fees that a student themselves could earn and put themselves through college.
It was
that
usually something like around $9 per unit, and also you had to pay for your books.
Yeah, it was.
I mean, I'm talking about
California
here in California.
Was one of the better states. I myself was educated in New York State, which was also a good state that way. But the point is, I mean, you could do it. Okay, here we go back
right.
to that American dream. You know, you work hard and you know, and you improve yourself. But the point is this: what we've got now, and again, it's done carefully. It's done slowly, and we have a certain amnesia toward our own history. But what's happened is what we've introduced is nothing less than a class of indentured servants. Because what
exactly.
happens, we tell young people, first of all, that you need to go to university. Now, I want to be very careful about this, okay? I think university is a right, okay? If you can qualify for entrance into the university, the state should pay for that, okay? I believe that to the bottom of my heart. However, I also, and I believe anybody who wants to go to the university should be able to. But I also believe that it's wrong to tell people that, well, a university education is the only way to go. I mean,
right.
there are, you know, contemporary modern places, okay? I mean, places like Germany, places like Sweden, that have comprehensive apprenticeship programs, okay, that, you know, they understand that not everybody, you know, is the kind of person who gravitates toward university. I mean, there are people who are very good at fixing stuff. I mean, we need plumbers. We need electricians, okay? I mean, we need auto mechanics, okay? And if, you know, and there is a lot of intrinsic motivation to that work. I mean, why do we not have an educational system that teaches people how to do stuff? And
exactly.
then why don't we have an economy that pays these people commensurate with their contributions to society? I mean, where
uh-huh.
does it say that because somebody, you know, works physically or works with their hands, that they don't deserve to have a prosperous living? I mean, that's ludicrous. One would have thought, and, you know, particularly with post-World War II prosperity, that we'd gotten beyond that. Where, you know, because we did get a middle class in America, and regular working people got to have a reasonable standard of living, and that's all going away. And people are confused. You know, they don't see why it's going away. But it's going away because of very deliberate policies that are put in by a government that is owned by the 1% who is using that government for its exclusive self-interest. And, you know, we just need to encourage people to think about that so that they see. And you know, and I truly believe that, you know, America has had an absolute talent for regeneration. And, you know, and my hope is that as people become aware of this, that we will take back our democratic institutions and once again begin to use
how do we do that, John?
Our collective resources for the good of all.
How do we take that back?
Well, what we need to do, Stuart, it begins by winning hearts and minds. I mean, what we need to do is people need to understand that they are being taken for a ride. Now, this is
right.
not mm-hmm. this is not a conspiracy theory. You know, it's not a
right.
cabal of secret bankers or something like this.
Right.
Okay, what it is, it's the logical result of the logic of the capitalist system. Okay, I mean, the system itself is based on exploitation. So what we have to say is people have to realize that, wait a minute, you know, the way that markets allocate wealth is determined by the rules those markets play under. And the rules those markets play under now is dictated by the 1% for their sole benefit. And what we need to do, okay, number one, we need to understand that markets are not infallible. Okay, markets are fine for some things, okay? I mean, hey, if you want to own a restaurant, you know, free markets work, okay? But,
right.
I mean, but the point is, if you actually control the means of production, what that ownership translates into is power, and then you can use that power to slant things to suit yourself. So what happens is, since all wealth is socially generated, okay, produced, actual wealth is produced by people working together, the benefits and proceeds from that wealth, the uses of it need to be determined, again, by all people together. And that's what our democratic institutions are for. So first and
foremost,
what we need to do is to educate people so that people understand
right.
just how they're being exploited. And then
right.
once they do, we actually do have democratic institutions in this country. It'll be a struggle, but
right.
the people can take them back. I mean, we have to insist that we are not going to listen to the Republicans. We are not going to listen to the Democrats. We are not going to be lulled to sleep by their lies. We are not going to believe that this is the best of all possible worlds. Because honestly, Stuart, you know, guys like you and I who have been around, it's in the course of our living memory, we can see how much conditions have deteriorated. So don't tell me this is the best of all possible worlds, because I can remember one that was distinctly better.
Okay. Hey, John, on that, what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you, you're going to have the last word around a minute or so, just to give a closing statement on this subject that we had today. Today we have John Strinker. He's joined our program in the past, and today we have been discussing Wall Street gains and working people. And, John, just take a minute or so just to give your closing statement on that, and then I would like for you to give contact information how people can reach you.
Okay. I hadn't thought in terms of a closing statement. I was fascinated by your topic. I was very happy to take part. But my closing statement is basically this, is I think, and I want to tie this into socialism, we are at a moment of needing to win hearts and souls. And because of, you know, historical circumstances, there is a lot of misperception about what socialism is and what it's about. But the thing is this. I mean, Americans have always been a cooperative people, an enterprising people, a people who work together, a people of communities, a people of fair play. All right? We need to go back to that. That's not some kind of foreign idea. That's embedded in our core documents, okay? We believe, you know, these inalienable truths, that all men are created equal. And if all men are created equal, then they need to have equal opportunities to fulfill their lives to the best of the potential. What's happened is we've gotten so far off the track that we're being ruled by, you know, the 1%, you know, an economic aristocracy that is every bit as brutal as our feudal past. And once again, we the people need to see to secure our own liberty. So,
and John, how can people reach you?
Okay, you can reach me. I'm on Facebook, John Strinka. I've got a Facebook page.
And could you spell
also,
that?
Also, my email is at HoosierSocialist@gmail.com. Can be reached.
Hey, John, once again, we thank you for joining the program, and we look forward to having you back on in the future, okay?
Hey, thank you very much, dude. I enjoyed it enormously.
And thank you, Ruth Ann, and thanks for joining the Socialist Insight. We'll see you next week.
Thank you.
Good night.
Bye.
You're listening to Air Marte Fio Radio, your source for the alternative viewpoint to the news around you. In between the amazing shows here, I invite you to check out Rocked Soul Radio, the latest source for alternative music and metaphysical talk on the web. Click over to rockedsoulradio.com or find us on the Live 365 mobile app by searching Rocked Soul Radio. That's Rocked, R-O-C-K-D, Soul Radio.
Ruth Ann? Ruth Ann?
Oh, okay. I don't know if you're muted or not. I can't seem to get you there.
Ruth Ann, can you hear me? Okay, let me call back.
Okay, everyone's here.
You're listening to Air Marte Fio on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience.
Welcome to the Research Rabbit Hole Radio Show with Cynthia Hamill. Tonight we have special guest Rick Wilson from Scream the News, who started questioning 9/11 after realizing how it changed the world. And so he dedicated thousands of hours of research to get to the bottom of this, why it happened, who was behind it, and why it is important to realize this today, the effects that we continue to realize day to day after 9/11. Rick, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Cynthia. It's great to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, glad to have you back. So tell us what you've been working on with PNAC, Project for a New American Century.
Well, I think PNAC is Project for a New American Century. Not a lot of people, I think, are aware of how that is related to 9/11. Basically, that project was started in 1997. It's basically a think tank that they put on the front is to help to geopolitically engage the United States moving forward to protect our borders, to strengthen our allies and so forth that we have with other countries and so forth like that. However, it also has a nefarious side. The Project for a New American Century, some of the scripters and authors of some of the letters that were sent to President George Bush just before 9/11, including Wolfowitz, Cheney was a part of that, Condoleezza Rice, many others, allude to the fact that in order for some of these geopolitical changes to occur, for us to take down Saddam Hussein, it was specifically mentioned, and other countries were mentioned, for us to do that in the Middle East, barring any sort of new Pearl Harbor incident, it would take a very long time to achieve that.
Right.
I think you've done some research on PNAC as well, and that people, was it 9 months before, basically, 9/11, when that was presented to George Bush and so forth?
You know, I think that this was written in 2007, the primary data for PNAC, according to my research, but I think you're right. I think that about 9 months prior to that, the mention of a new Pearl Harbor surfaced, so I would have to go back and look exactly, but I think you're right.
Well, it's interesting, too, that, whether it was planned or it wasn't, it was extremely interesting timing, perfect timing, just almost unbelievable timing,
yeah,
if you will, for us
exactly
to immediately move into Iraq and subsequent countries afterwards. So it's almost as if the people, you know, in charge and so forth in our government, in the U.S. government, almost got lucky that 9/11 happened. I know that might sound a weird way to say it, but when their agenda was to invade these other countries, that was a perfect starting point, a perfect fulcrum and catalyst to move forward with that.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely correct with that. And I think it's also important to mention probably about 95% of the American population has not even heard of the Project for a New American Century. Even, you know, the highly educated people and people who park themselves right in front of their new, you know, nightly news every single night have not even heard about this, PNAC, P-N-A-C, the Project for a New American Century. So it's very important to find out how all this dovetails in together, almost like the perfect puzzle. If you're looking at it like a, you know, a complete mosaic and a puzzle, this is a huge piece of what actually happened with 9/11. And if people can't see this and they're just going to the new movie that came out on, you know, the death of bin Laden. I just talked with a couple last week out at a karaoke show, and they were telling me that they were in the know because they just came back from the bin Laden movie and were spilling off all this stuff, but yet they did not realize that PNAC was involved or that there were numerous other details of 9/11 that they'd not even taken into account. So I think even people who feel like they're in the know need to know this other, you know, information, right?
And I would completely agree with that. And I think it's important for them to know, to realize, not just when you say, so what does PNAC have to do with, again, Project for a New American Century, this think tank, our government, our trusting government, that a lot of people sort of have that illusion that, you know, our government is our savior and they're here to protect us and so forth, that there's a lot more to it. And 9/11 is a great example of a continuation, not just from 9/11, but here going forward. And that's why it's important that we're talking about this. If you can, I recommend for folks to research PNAC, and I'll throw out some names: Paul Wolfowitz, George Weigel, Donald Rumsfeld, Dan Quayle, Dick Cheney, you know, Elliot Cohen, Jeb Bush, Marvin Bush, Steve Forbes. A lot of these people are Scooter Libby. A lot of these people were involved with this sort of think tank, which supposedly on the outside is supposed to be a very good thing for the United States geopolitically. However, things like this can result from it, where reports are sent, letters are sent to enact wars on false pretenses. So I think it's important for folks to realize that as well.
Right. And when people enact wars on false pretenses, often this is what is called a false flag operation. So that's an important thing for people to know, because a lot of people have not heard that term. I did not ever hear that term. It was something that was just disclosed, I believe, like 4.5 years ago to me when I was an Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth meeting with Richard Gage, and he first announced that, and I was like, oh my gosh, holy cow. There's a strategy here that they actually stage an event, like a wartime event, that pulls the American public into another war or altercation. And I had never even thought of that, like actually staging something that would actually, you know, hurt or damage or kill American lives, American people, in order to get us involved in some type of overseas, you know, Middle Eastern conflict.
Well, and that's the thing, too, I have to admit as well, for me, I had not heard that term false flag until maybe 2005 or so. When I first heard it, I thought maybe it was a new cookie that was out from, that was like an Oreo. I had no idea. Okay, that was a bad joke. But anyway, let's also keep in mind that we're not just talking about America. History does repeat itself. And that's the thing, too, with Americans sometimes thinking, oh, our country can never do that. Well, what's the difference from other countries? If you look what Hitler did with the Reichstag fire, so if people want to research that, that was blamed on someone else. It was done by his group to burn down this building, the Reichstag, so they could blame someone else, another country, so they could go to war. And this has been carried out for, I mean, this is sort of Art of War 101 type of mentality. This has gone for, I mean, the Chinese did this thousands of years ago. So this is not a new idea. It's just that we're not really ever taught that, you know, in our school systems or anything like that. We're taught to just think that whatever we hear on the news and whatever's parlayed to us information-wise, whatever's disseminated to us is the truth, especially if it's on the, you know, the radio or the news, the television, and so forth. But yes, false flags do exist, people, and it's a very powerful tool because it's very effective.
Yes.
It takes a natural instinct of people. It's natural kind of fight or flight emotion from people. When 9/11 happened, people were freaking out, of course, obviously so, justifiably. You know, our fellow Americans, we were attacked. So what instantly happens with the brain is, when you're going through trauma, is you want to place blame. You want to be able to lash back and blame somebody. So a false flag will create that, that immediate backlash, and if you can do it correctly, you can get the masses of your people to believe it's another entity. You can use that to go to war, and that's exactly what happened, and that's why we went into Iraq.
Right, and I just wanted to put in a little aside here. For those people who want to learn more about this, the false flag operations, I would check out the movie on YouTube called Loose Change, An American Coup, COUP. And that will fill you in on the identical, you know, pattern that the Nazi Germans ran on their situation, where they created a fire within one of their buildings and then blamed it on someone else in order to set all this legislation in effect that was almost identical to the Patriot Act bill, which was already written years ahead of when they even introduced the Patriot Act bill. So people think that they wrote it in like 3 weeks after 9/11, and that is totally bogus. This was written, you know, years ahead possibly, and then they just had basically this false flag thing that allowed them to pull this into effect. Is that you know, right to you, Rick, with your
research?
That's exactly
correct. The Enabling Act. I'm not sure if you said the exact one. The Enabling Act is what was done in the 30s under the Nazi regime. And if you compare that to the Patriot Act, it's almost word for word identical. And of course, that was written. You can't draft something like that within a couple of weeks. That would be approved, already going through the chain of command to even get to that level. Another interesting note on that: how quickly we already had Iraq ready to go. And people don't realize that from a military strategic standpoint. If you're going into theater, it's interesting that they call it theater because it's fake. Is that it takes months and months and months to plan strategically how we're going to place troops, what you're going to do, working with your allies. We immediately went into Iraq right after. So those plans were already in place. Again, great lucky timing that 9/11 happened when it did, coincidentally with the drafts from PNAC saying this is what we kind of need to move forward. So that's also something I'd like people to be aware of militarily. We were ready to go. We just needed an excuse. So if we need an excuse, the easiest way to do that would be to create one.
Right. And then if you also pair this information with Wesley Clark's visit to the Pentagon 10 days after 9/11, and he was given a list of 7 countries that would be slated for some type of American, you know, war efforts in those countries over a 5-year period, all of this was, you know, in effect as early as 10 days after 9/11. So they already knew this whole list of countries that they were going to be involved in just, you know, less than 10 days. I just can't believe that. Have you seen that video yet?
I have, and I want people to understand General Wesley Clark. He's, you know, he's very decorated general. Worked with the Pentagon, you know, in many different areas. And he was very forthcoming with coming out about that. And actually, his words were, we're going to take out 7 countries in 5 years, starting with Iraq. And then he mentioned also, I want to list them, Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and finishing off Iran. So, of course, it hasn't, the 5 years have come and gone. But if you look at the way that the United States government has been targeting other countries, they're pretty much on schedule as far as what their initial goal was to accomplishing that. So if anyone wants to, I would look that up for anyone, just to, you know, just YouTube or Google General Wesley Clark, 7 countries in 5 years. And it's very astonishing that someone from a general would say that, knowing, of course, that his peers and those that are in, kind of in power wouldn't want that information to get out. You know, if you can't recognize that, what are you missing? That he said that, and it's happening.
Right. And then the other thing I thought was very interesting about his speech in particular was the fact that he mentioned that this would be that we've already had an American policy coup. So he was already stating that something internal has happened within our inner, you know, linings of government that allowed all of this to take place. So he was calling this an American policy coup. And then he went on to say some hard-nosed blah, 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 talking about people who were on the inside of this program who had already, you know, created this and manifested this without Congress's approval. This was like an inside faction of people who were doing their own thing. They're running their own program, basically. Isn't that what you heard?
No, that's completely true. Yeah, he did use those words. It's a policy coup. What's important for that, I think, for people to understand is when we're talking about this, just to say, oh, so it's a policy coup. You know, like, you hear this. Here's sports. Here's CNN. Somebody got murdered. Somebody got killed. There's a policy coup in some country, including ours, and then blah, 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 blah. How important that is, what his words were, knowing that when he was going to be saying this, the backlash that he would get for doing that. It's a policy coup in our American government. That is someone very decorated, very trustworthy in our government saying, by the way, our government's been taken over by a small group of people. And a lot of those, or some of those people are, you know, associated with PNAC, of course. You know, Dwight Eisenhower in his farewell speech mentioned the same thing, that, you know, our government's going to eventually, he can just see it, our government's going to be taken over by this sort of shadow government. So, you know, when we're going back and forth about, I'm a Democrat, you're a Republican, and, you know, if it's Obama or it's Romney in office, I think people need to kind of step back. I don't want to tangent too much with that, but just in a general sense that there's people pulling the strings behind the scene, behind the curtain. And that's one of the things that General Wesley Clark was trying to allude to.
Exactly.
There's more to it.
Yes. And then, you know, in my research today, I was looking up all the remote-controlled landings possibly into the World Trade Center, and I recommend a video on 9/11 pods and remote control plane theory that you can find on YouTube. And then, you know, this is interesting how all of this information dovetails in, but there was a guy on, you know, PNAC, a member of PNAC named Dov Zakheim, Z-A-K-H-E-I-M. He was one of the people who was a CEO of Systems Planning Corporation who created the AWACS, CTS Remote Controlled Flight Controller, that actually allows you to hit a target remotely through a plane application. So there's a video out, which I just mentioned, the 9/11 pods and remote control plane theory. So if you go and look at that, you can actually see the bottom of the plane, and under the belly of that plane, there's a contraption that is showing like this shadowing device that they clearly go over in that video, where you can see this is not like a visual illusion here. This is actually an object that's you know, firmly underneath that plane that's showing a shadow and an outline and everything, where you can clearly see it. And it looks exactly like the remote control plane theory things that you can pull up online. And I even went back through, and on my Facebook page, I posted some information where people could actually find this and go to this. So if you wanted to go to an explanation of this, there's an explanation on 9/11 fireman explosion testimony, page 2, on David Icke's official forums, where a guy even shows 2 pictures of this you know, remote control flight stuff that was actually on the underbelly of that plane. So I think that's something that people need to look up and look into, because this is a very important aspect of possibly how they carried off 9/11. You know, we still have a lot of theories, and people are still debating about a number of things and chat threads online and stuff like that. We all have our own opinions, but I think that this is definitely something to look into. I think it's more than just a shadow under the plane. So it's almost like that building called in the plane just like a homing pigeon. You know, basically it was just like flying along, and it hit a target that all the people, all the top pilots in 9/11 for Truth or whatever their group is called, they are saying, you know, even people with tremendous 20 years of flight experience, they could not fly these planes directly into the targets that were hit. So this explains that phenomena. So I think that that's an important aspect to mention. So have you gone into any of that, Rick?
I have. I'm not sure the exact video. I'll have to look at that later, but I have seen many videos, and I know exactly what you mean. It's not only that, it's also ground testimony, eyewitness testimony with videos, you know, with camcorders and cell phones and so forth, showing the plane coming in. And there is that pod, and I think so that folks don't understand why we're bringing that up. Basically, the reason we're talking about this is we're suggesting it's possible that it wasn't an American Airlines or United Airlines passenger plane. It was in fact a military style plane that was form fitted with this underbelly pod, and it's very obvious that there's more to it as far as, you know, the structure of the plane. Remote control technology has existed for many, many decades. It, you know, it's just on what scale. I know Boeing did that in the, I think it was the late 70s or early 80s when they did many takeoffs and landings, and sometimes the planes would crash, but they completely from remote control. So setting like some sort of, like, as you said, sort of a homing device or a target just makes sense. That technology obviously exists. Something else too is when you're talking about that with the planes going in the way that they did with that technology. I'll say that for later. I wanted to get to a different type of technology, but I'm glad that you said that there's different theories. So we're not saying we know for sure. We're not claiming that we know for sure what happened. We have strong theories. What we're saying is let's have a new investigation, you know.
Exactly. And then did you realize that the exact floors that were hit by the planes were reinforced for fire resistance? Now, this we're talking about in World Trade Center, the Towers 1 and 2, as well as the Pentagon. All three of those structures were reinforced for fire resistance. And instead of fire protection, my theory and what I've been thinking about is that instead of, you know, just installing the fire protection, I'll bet that they installed a remote-controlled radar gadget that led those planes into the towers just like a freaking homing pigeon. So that's my concept on it. Intuitively, when I saw that, I was like, and when I started seeing these videos and I started putting all this together, I was like, holy cow, that's how they pulled this thing off, you know. So that's my take on it. When I saw it, and you may have a different view, Rick, I don't know, but I just thought I would express it. I thought I'd express my side of things first.
Well,
so you go.
Okay.
What's your take on it?
Yeah, well, intuitively, you picked up that something was not right.
Exactly.
The towers, both of them, for weeks before, the security was pulled. The bomb-sniffing dogs were pulled. There was a security company called Securicom, which was also known as Strata Tech, I believe. The main principal holder of that is Marvin Bush. He was also in charge of the security at Dulles and Logan airports, where those two planes supposedly took off from, and, you know, the Twin Towers at the time, which is interesting. But I'm thinking more because the dog-sniffing bomb-sniffing dogs were pulled beforehand. I don't think it would be that difficult to place some sort of homing device, because they spent weeks doing that. And there's eyewitness testimony from security guards and so forth that it was very strange the weeks leading up. You know, everything that happened, their shifts changed, and the security companies would come in and they were doing work and no one really knew what they were doing. I think no matter what your theories are, there's probably more to it than just a homing sort of device, because I think that would be a very basic thing to do. But I do think that they were definitely lining thermite and thermite with explosives. Now, there's different theories, but whatever theories you want to go with, it is strange that the weeks leading up to it, these companies were allowed to come in, and it was all hush-hush, and they were doing something to these buildings.
Right, and then there were also the security-type white vans that were showing up between the hours of, like, 2 in the morning to about 5:30 a.m. before the bigwigs hit the building, and these were apparently coming and going months before 9/11, like 3 months even before 9/11, coming in those hours. So, you know, who can explain that? And this was caught, I think, on somebody's security camera. So they had evidence that these white vans were pulling up. So did you hear about that part?
Oh, I did. And it's actually, and I wish I remembered her name. I'm sorry. There's someone that worked for the Pentagon, and that came across her desk. And she's come out and said that this came across her desk, that this was a very strange thing. She subsequently got fired from her position in the Pentagon. That, yes, she can attest to that. And I don't have her name. I'll have to follow up with that. But she claims that, yes, there were vans that basically got there before the morning, you know, like, you know, after the cleaning crews and before people would come in the morning. So between, like you said, between 2 and 6 a.m. or something like that. You know, like you said, I don't know if it was weeks or months, but enough of a period leading up to where it's questionable why.
Right.
Who's in charge of that was the same security companies that were PNAC members and members of the Bush family, which also leads back to like Saudi ties of companies as well, which is, I guess, another whole rabbit hole to go down some other time.
Right, and that rabbit hole is pretty well covered in the book called The Big Bamboozle by Philip Marshall, who was just killed with his 2 children and family dog in Northern California. So this book is profound because he links Saudi Arabia as being the bulk of the hijackers, and also basically gives the information that bin Laden had actually died in 2001 from Marfan's disease, and can back that up with a number of different quotes from Petraezek. I think that's how you pronounce it. It's P-I-E-C-Z-E-N-I-K, a general who could back up and testify to this. So his book is profound. I highly recommend that one, and I feel like anyone who's researching 9/11 should look at this, because this man basically lost his life along with his family, I feel like, due to what he was disclosing within his books. And his third book that he was writing on 9/11 was going to disclose the fallacy of bin Laden's death and how he actually died in 2001. So I think the timing of that's very interesting.
Again, it's just very lucky, interesting timing. It seems to be anyone that, and this is true for even people within lower levels of government, people that were victims, family members, whoever were going to testify to Congress about 9/11, about what they knew and what witnessed, just mysteriously seemed to disappear.
Right.
Just a weird sort of thing. And that seems to be a prevalent consistency.
Yes, there's
which
a whole
is very
video.
Unfortunate. I mean, what are they really scared of, honestly? You know, well, I'm being sarcastic, but of course they're scared, because if people are going to testify to what they know, then the public would be aware of what really happened. You know, the firefighters were not allowed to testify. The ones that were there, the first responders, were not allowed to testify.
Wow.
Those should be huge red flags for people. So people that say that, okay, so why are we talking about this? What's the difference between any series that we have versus the original story is this. Folks, I'm sorry to tell you this, and it's not easy to hear. The least likely theory you will ever hear is the official story that you heard on CNN or from the 9/11 Commission report, that 19 hijackers with box cutters with some sort of communication from a laptop in a cave in Afghanistan pulled off everything that happened on 9/11. I'm going to have to say it. That is complete bullshit. Occam's razor. I'm sorry.
I back you up.
That is the least likely of anything. And when I say that, it's not an easy thing to grasp. It's not an easy thing to hear or conceive, because once you do that, you're allowing yourself to be vulnerable where, okay, if they did have anything to do with it, if my government did have anything to do with it, or even if they were just complicit in not bringing forth what they knew or anything along those lines, then that makes you as a human being have to be very vulnerable and sort of scared and realize they're not all out there to help you and love you and do what's in your best interest. So I understand why people are afraid to hear about that, but folks, that is the least likely logical explanation, is the official story.
You know, this type of thing gave me, when I first, you know, heard about it, almost like a chronic anxiety attack, where like for 2 to 3 weeks after this, I could barely sleep because I was like, oh my gosh, you know, like, I can't believe, you know, what I'm seeing and what I'm hearing on Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, that there are actually 800 people, and that was, you know, 4.5 years ago, 800 people who are professionals in steel building constructions that are all questioning how these buildings fell that day. And then you look at Dr. Judy Wood, you look at her information on this is possibly a directed energy weapon, and looking at Hurricane Erin that was brewing on, you know, the East Coast that day, that was barely even mentioned by our top weather sources, and that thing rerouted and went completely right, like right before 9/11. And you look at this whole energy dynamic and how those buildings dustified in sheer air. You can actually see it before your eyes watching these videos as the building is just absolutely exploding and catapulting all over the place. I mean, you know, people need to do their homework. You know, I can't do it for you. You've actually got to watch these videos yourself. You know what I mean? Wouldn't you agree, Rick?
I completely do, and I want to get into the directed energy weapons and Dr. Judy Wood as well, but I do want to touch one more time back on, it's a great website, you've mentioned it a couple times, but it's AE, so Alpha Echo, 911truth.org, which is Architects and Engineers for 911truth.org, and when you were mentioning, you know, the planes, possible pod planes and so forth, remote control planes, Lear, you know, Lear Jet, his son has over 30,000 hours of flight time. These are pilots that know their stuff, and they would go into simulators and say they could not possibly pull off, like, aiming for a building. It's impossible. You would have to be so lucky to pull it off once in a million tries, let alone twice or three times or what have you. So, again, I think that's a great website, AE911truth.org, and like you said, engineers, architects, pilots, seasoned veterans, and then with accolades. If
right.
They're saying, please consider to understand that if their information, what they're giving you, doesn't go with what you're used to, what you're hearing on the news, just to give it a chance and just research for yourself. Like you were
and
saying.
They also now have a major movie called Experts Speak Out, which is about 2.5 hours long, I believe. And that gives you some expert, you know, professional interviews from top architects and steel structured engineers talking about how, you know, basically the whole official story of these buildings falling due to a fire is just absolutely, completely a fabrication. Because it looks to me like after you see this video and you see all the many angles and the different video clips and all the interviews, you're going to see exactly kind of what's on the inside of this. And there's now 1,700 architects and engineers that are all coming forward saying the official story of 9/11 is completely bogus. So I think it's definitely worth people's while to look at that video. And if you don't have time to watch 2.5 hours of that, at least pull up Richard Gage's 10-minute speech that he gives. You can Google Richard Gage 10-minute speech. he will show you in that 10 minutes just the questions on building number 7, which a lot of people don't realize. Building number 7 fell at about 5:30 p.m. that day without a single plane hitting. So you cannot blame jet fuel for taking out that building. It fell in less than 7 seconds, folks. So please do your homework and, you know, watch the videos on that. And this will definitely give you an insider scoop that something's up with this. We need to look at this. This is not what was reported on our mainstream televisions that day. There is more to the story. Right, Rick?
You know, yes. And I'd also like to say this. I want everyone to, just from a logical standpoint, notice some red flags. If there's a couple thousand architects, engineers, and so forth that are questioning 9/11, why would they be doing that? This isn't, and you've experienced this, I've experienced this, backlash from family members and friends. Like, what, you're just trying to cause trouble? No, we know fully well right now, even just doing this show, that we are putting ourselves out there. We're not saying that we need to be right. We want a new investigation. But for folks to understand that a lot of architects, engineers, pilots, whoever it is, people in the government, that come forward will get fired. They will be threatened sometimes. It's not an easy thing to do. So if you have that many people, here's what I'm saying, just please logically look at it. If you have that many people saying, we are really questioning this, look at what they have to gain. They don't have anything to gain. They have everything to lose. So that should be sort of an indicator of how important it is and why. Yes, it's physically impossible for the official story to be true. And this is obvious when you look at it. So when people are questioning that, understand that they're under pressure to not speak up about it, and they still are.
Exactly. So, Rick, tell us a personal story of why did you come forward and actually come out, so to speak, on this issue? What made you speak up about it and actually talk about it?
You know, I'm kind of a smartass by nature. When you said come out, it's like if I was gay, that's what it would feel like. Honestly, I hate to say that. I'm not trying to equate that. But that's how it feels. Like, it was so scary to come out with these are my beliefs, because when I did, I mean, I'm going to be honest. You know, my parents, my family, my aunts, uncles, the girlfriend at the time. And so forth. This was back in 2004, 2005, and you alluded to that movie. I think you alluded to maybe a remake of what they did, but it was Loose Change.
Yeah.
And I saw it, and kind of like what you said, I immediately at first just was like, oh, whatever. And then I started looking at it and taking it in, and I got sick to my stomach, and it really affected me. But then trying to explain that to people is not easy, because we're all indoctrinated to say, oh, you're a conspiracy nut, without actually looking at the facts and the evidence. And you're put down without actually having rational discussions. Now, since then, I will say that I'm not going to say her name, but one of my grandmothers I turned her into sort of a conspiracy theorist now, because she and generationally, that's kind of important, because you know, of her age, she's around 80, and she's looking at things with that, and she's understanding facts, and she sends me information. But anyway, I don't want to get too personal with all that, but just that, so people know, it's not easy, yes, to kind of come out and say, I don't believe what the news tells you every day. And, you know, I know you had it kind of rough too, but not,
yes.
You probably had it worse than I did.
Well, I was dealing with, you know, telling this to a mother who was sick and was not, you know, in the best of health at that time, and had already told me that she anticipated dying. So when I came forward and told her, you know, that I had found this out, she was like, you know, is it really good that you talk about this, or do you have to bring this up? And so I kind of tippy-toed around on eggshells for the next eight or so months until she passed away, not speaking about it, just putting a lid on it, because I didn't want to hurt her feelings, and I also just didn't want to, you know, upset the apple cart. You know, I knew that word would get back to her if I started posting about it, or, you know, going out on a limb speaking about it or something. So I, you know, I honored my mother and I just kept my mouth shut. But, you know, after she passed away, I was like, you know, Cynthia, you had this vision of, you know, seeing, you know, something other than 9/11 when it happened. I was seeing a vision of King Kong literally on the top of the Empire State Building fighting off jets. And sometimes things come to me like in a very intuitive flash, you know, where it's like, bang, you know, you get this vision of King Kong fighting off jets on top of the Empire State Building. And it's like, wow, okay, this is a staged event. You know, this is what my intuition is trying to break through and tell me. So I have to just honor that and just go with it. And then, you know, at some point it makes sense. It's like I start looking at all these videos that we've got of video teams that are analyzing possibly even the dynamics that, you know, the films from CBS and the other news stories look to be a computer animated imagery where actually they can mimic identically one plane to the other, showing, you know, the plane footage of the gray steel plane flying in that looks, you know, that is the footage that we were shown on the day of 9/11 compared to a red image of a plane flying in. On the exact same timing, they're able to show the exact same angle, the exact same crash based on computer-generated animation. So if you go to this video, let me pull it up on my Facebook page. I posted this a couple of days ago, but it's fascinating stuff because when you see this, and you know, I have a background in computer graphics, so when I look at it, I'm seeing, oh, yeah, that's why that ghost, that's why that wing ghosted out, because whoever's doing this program didn't know how to actually animate it all the way in. So they, like, fudged, and that wing actually ghosted out. So if you go to this on YouTube, if you go to this video called Theory of a Ghost Plane, that's what it's labeled, you will see this complete animation of the real time plane that was shown on, you know, CBS and a computer animated version of that in a red version that flies right on top of that, that shows this exact parallel, exact image. And then they show you how they create and pull up all these programs on how they created and manifested the flash. So I just think, you know, I'm not saying this is a complete answer. I'm just saying here's part of a theory. Look at it, because there's something here. There's some meat to this discussion. If you just pull up and look at that video, Theory of a Ghost Plane, like, why does that wing ghost out? Well, there's more to the story. So if you watch that video, you'll see what I'm talking about. So enough of that sales pitch. Rick, what do you have to say about this?
Well, no, that's interesting. To me, it almost doesn't matter as much, because I know that, you know, hologram technology exists. This has been proven. What you're basically talking about, and I don't have a computer background like you do, but like a green screen effect, when, you know, someone will kind of fade in or out their ear, and you can tell instead of the background that you see of the city, it's just it's commonality with movies and so forth. Yeah, so those things can be, you know, easily manipulated. But whether we saw a computer manipulation of a plane, whether it was a real plane, it definitely was not the type of – it was probably most likely, if there was a plane, a military-style plane. But again, I love talking about these theories because who knows which one is true. But I think another way to bring that back is to say, because this is what I really think, it doesn't matter as much. Instead of knowing, the official story is so full of it, what does that mean? If our government is capable of doing that, you know, I'm not going to say what my theory is, but, you know, I'm going to allude to certain things, Mossad and so forth, with the, you know, fearing Israelis and everything else. Whatever happened was not the official story. And also with that, I think it's good that we're talking about it anyway, to put some of this technology out there so people can research it. Because when you're talking about this, like a Photoshop version, if you will, or, you know, holographic imagery does exist. And also when you were alluding earlier to Judy Wood with, you know, direct weapon technology that people don't know does exist, using, like, you know, microwaves, ELFs, radio waves,
harp,
ultraviolet, going on and on and on. And I think that she's done some interesting work. I don't know if I agree with all that, but I think that's something to look into, and it's very interesting.
Yeah, you know, my take on it, there's a lot of discussion in some of the chat threads and even some of the meetings that I've been to with my 9/11 groups, stating that certain subjects are kind of taboo to bring up because it may be a disinformation agent type angle or something like that. And so my thinking on that is, as an artist and somebody who comes at, you know, at life kind of like, well, let's just look at this whole big puzzle, you know, let's just see what's out there and not narrow anything down, just kind of like be like a rabbit in the garden, just looking for the next clue, you know, kind of like my radio show is the Research Rabbit Hole, you know. We're out there just looking at all these different theories and, you know, don't get hung up on which is the right way or which is the wrong way or this is disinformation and this is the real deal. You know, don't label anything, because that's when you shut off yourself to actually finding the answer and possibly coming up with something that would be profound. So my thinking on this is, you know, just to stay with the story and see what presents itself, because all of this stuff has some type of merit. I mean, it's an amazing study, if nothing else. This has just kept my, like, research rabbit and my Nancy Drew side and, you know, all this stuff going, you know, for like, 10, 11 years now. It's just been fascinating. So this has pulled me away from karaoke, for heaven's sake. So it's been a miracle in that respect, you know?
Well, if it can pull you from karaoke, then the world's a better place. All right, so that was a bad joke. But
I'm just kidding.
No, I know, but I'm glad you said that, because we can have this discussion, and you know, and this was interesting when we're talking about before who you can talk to. I found that social media is a great way to get like-minded people. You mentioned 9/11 groups you belong to, and I have some, and I have my own page and stuff, and we talk about things like this without emotion. We're just presenting information. Take what you will. We're not claiming that we know everything. We're just saying research it, you know, and it's very interesting, and you can learn a lot by doing that, by choosing to do that. Now, that's obviously difficult because of cognitive dissonance. And so for people that don't know what that term means, cognitive dissonance basically is you have two separate, you know, things emotionally toward you, like it's either this or it's this, and you get confused and you get fearful. So I alluded to, like, if you've been religious your whole life and someone says, you know, God doesn't exist, instead of having a discussion about that, you will go into your shell. And it's the same thing with 9/11. So whether it's true or not or whatever, maybe the official story is true, I really doubt. But it's good to be able to have these discussions rationally. And it's, you're right, any theory is welcome. It's fine. And it's how we learn how we can get to the bottom of it, because I can guarantee you our government has not done anything to get to the bottom of it. And that's actually quite scary.
Right. You know, one thing that I'd like to refer people to that I find is very interesting for those people who are on the fence and who've not really dabbled into the research very much, I would like to pull you into an article called 24 Hard Facts About 9/11 That Cannot Be Debunked. So this is written, it's on the internet that you can actually find very easily. And you know, this mentions like nanothermite found in the dust, you know, the fact that 1,700 architects and engineers support a real independent 9/11 investigation, you know, the total collapse of World Trade Center Building Number 7 fell in under 7 seconds, at 6.5 seconds, at free fall acceleration. You know, the fact that Dick Cheney was in command of NORAD on 9/11 while running war games and ordered a stand down order, you know. So this thing is loaded with points like that all the way through, 24 different points that are irrefutable. So I feel like everybody needs to at least do that amount of homework, you know, and pull this thing up and just see what's out there. See that this is, you know, these are facts. They can't be denied. And then the fact that they were actually running war game exercises, Vigilant Warrior, if you can Google that term. And if you pull up the book Solving 9/11 by Christopher Boleyn, he dedicates an entire chapter to the false flag operations that have run at the same time that some major episodes have happened, including Sandy Hook. There was a little boy that was interviewed that said this was just a drill. It's actually on the internet. If you pull this up and pull up and Google YouTube and Sandy Hook, you can pull up boy drill, and you're going to find that interview. So, I mean, there's some very interesting things once you start looking at this, particularly in regards to the war games that were happening, and, you know, it's called Vigilant Warrior, if you can pull that up. Rick, do you know much about the Vigilant Warrior exercises that were planned that day?
I do, actually. Well, I'm not familiar as much with that one, but I know there were three or four, and they were different names and so forth, with different Air Force bases with the military on that day, where our fighters and so forth were flown hundreds of miles away on an exercise that did depict aircraft being hijacked. And they never do that. We don't have these exercises very often. It's interesting that it happened that day. Yes.
Right.
Also, NORAD, air traffic controllers and so forth, the miscommunication between there. If you look at there's audio tapes. I don't have the name of it, but you can YouTube it or Google it. There's actual, I think it's called interference, perhaps. They'll lay out the actual communication between NORAD and the Justice Department and who else was involved and how to get scrambled jets out to intercept these planes and so forth. And if you look at that kind of thing, it's very obvious. These were staged coincidentally on the same day, of course. And just like you said, Sandy Hook, I hate a tangent, but I can't help it. The sheriff himself ran drills, and it was on the news a month before then with a different school. And it was the first time ever. But anyway, the same thing with the London tube bombing, 7/7. Some of the first responders were there because they said we were here to run a drill for some reason in this tube, the subway.
Wow.
And that's the same day it happened. So there's a lot of things consistently when you look at that that would, you know, take what you will, but it is very interesting. 9/11, yes. Vigilant, Guardian, this is off the top of my head. There's many different drills that were going on. Scrambling jets, basically air traffic controllers could not tell if they were exercises or real world scenarios, and their radars were going crazy. This was all planned. So I'll say this. If the official story is true, we should really, really give some credit to Bin Laden and those 19 guys with box cutters, because they somehow figured out, they're that intelligent, to completely eradicate the United States' entire military system, information, defense, everything. So if the official story is true, it's almost unbelievable. I'd be shocked, Cynthia.
And Rick, not only that, but they leaked, and this is mentioned in Philip Marshall's book, The Big Bamboozle, they leaked from regular car bombing incidents to doing this entire huge military, showdown that was unbelievable. They fooled and stymied our complete Defense Department. They leaped from, just car bombs, in one instance, all the way to this type of thing. How does that even happen?
Well, also, how did they, these terrorist Muslims, these Arabs, how did they get Cheney to become one of the first guys ever as a vice president to all of a sudden take over NORAD that same day? I mean, they did a really good job. Okay, my sarcasm might be seeping through at this point. They did a really good job of, fooling everyone in our own government.
And then pulling off the security, the bomb-sniffing dogs in the security buildings, and bringing in the white paneled trucks that were there like 3 weeks to 3 months before the incident of 9/11. So how on earth did they pull all of this off? And not to mention that, but how did they pull off the mysterious deaths of 9/11? If you pull up that video on YouTube, there's over 20 people that were killed as a result of being an eyewitness to 9/11. So how on earth can people in the outback caves of Afghanistan or Pakistan actually do that? Why would they knock off all these eyewitnesses? It just doesn't make sense. Does it?
No, it makes complete sense because they're Muslims and they hate us for our freedoms.
But you mean they're going to track down eyewitnesses to 9/11 on our own turf?
They've already infiltrated our entire system. Yes. All right. So there's my sarcasm. Also, how did they, you know, fly a plane into a building, the Pentagon, where there was no plane found? And even Rumsfeld the next day said the missile hit the building. I don't know. However they did it, we need to cater our intelligence services after theirs, these individuals, especially since they all died and none of their names were on any flight manifests. Not only did they pull that off, but they actually, half of them are still alive. So that's just bizarre as well. And, you know, there's something that these terrorist Muslims know that we don't. And,
you know, I just want to know how they made the quantum leap from car bombs 1 week to, like, taking out the World Trade Center building. That's phenomenal progress. You know, any way you slice it, don't you think?
No, it really – I'm sorry. I, you know, you can obviously tell I'm being sarcastic, yeah. And I hate to make fun of it. I mean, it's a serious subject. But, yeah, it's almost – it is unbelievable. They could barely fly a Cessna. They were horrible at it. When they took some training here in my state of Arizona and Tucson, and you know, their flight instructor said they couldn't – they couldn't handle like a small, tiny plane, yet they can do a 450-degree, whatever it is, turn spiral from their altitude without hitting the lawn and right into the Pentagon. When you talk to seasoned veteran pilots, very seasoned, will say that's impossible. No one can do that. I can't do that. How could someone that doesn't know how to fly a plane? It's way different flying a biplane than it is a 757. So. Yeah, it seems very unbelievable on so many levels. Again, I'll stop being sarcastic, but yeah, it's obviously the official story is just the least likely.
Well, Rick, we've got like 5 minutes to wrap this baby up. So what else would you like to say?
Just thank you for having me, and I hope that people just, you know, do research. Like you said, you mentioned some great science, and I think that, again, Architects and Engineers is a great one. It's AE911truth.org. That's a great start, you know. And it's important, folks, because it's been 12 years or so since, you know, this happened. But it's important to understand what our government is capable of and how to move forward with anything that happens. So once you become... allow yourself to become aware of these things, it becomes much easier to understand what your government is doing and then to help stop it if it's bad, you know.
Right. And again, I'd like to mention, you know, this is not our full government. I still feel like this is a very small faction of people who were involved in that PNAC, Project for a New American Century, that basically pulled this thing off. So, you know, when we say government, we're not talking about, you know, the average Joe Blow who's working for the government. We're talking about an insider group that knew all of these details and pulled this thing off from the inside. But I do feel like they also had some help from the outside, because if you pick up the book and read Solving 9/11 by Christopher Berlin, that book actually goes into more of the Israeli content and possibly the Mossad connection. So I do feel like people need to also balance their information and their research by reading that book as well as The Big Bamboozle by Philip Marshall. So both of those two I found to be completely eye-opening, as well as other books, too, that they mention on Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth and the work that Edward, you know, Ray Griffin has done and different people. So is there anything else that you'd like to mention, Rick?
No, and I think that's great. Ray Griffin, especially. I would like to say, out of all the videos, the books that I've read and so forth, Dr. Ray Griffin, he does a spectacular job of that. Yes. The other ones you mentioned when you're alluding to MI5, MI6, RAW, RAW, Mossad, you know, KGB, CIA, all those. There's a lot to look into that as well. But that's kind of down the road. That's like kind of baby steps, I think, for people to get too involved too quickly, perhaps. But yes, we're not claiming all the government is involved. It's called compartmentalization. They're not, everyone's even aware. It just takes a small group of people when others don't know what's going on. Just for example, the Manhattan Project employed over 200,000 people for the atomic bombs, but it was only a very few people that knew they would be creating an atomic bomb. So.
Great. Well, Rick Wilson, thank you so much for being on my show. I really appreciate it. Your information is incredible, and it was great to co-host with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, and everyone see me on Scream the News on Facebook.
Yeah, Scream the News. Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Cynthia. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Rick.